I asked. Shh, listen. I stood still, suppressing my shivering for a moment. I heard the susurration of rushing water very faintly in the distance. Which way is it coming from? Darla whispered. I pointed. Yeah, that's about what I thought, too. We can use the noise to figure out what direction we're going. Lead on. Darla pushed her way out of the foxhole into the deep snow. I followed, watching the snow, trying to place my feet in her footsteps. After a few minutes of that, I looked up and felt a surge of panic when I couldn't see her. Our chances were bad enough together. If we got separated, I didn't see how we'd survive. Well, Darla might. She knew how to make a fire. I fought down my fear. All I had to do was follow her trail. I ran for 20 or 25 feet, high-stepping through the snow. I almost bowled into Darla's back. She was trudging along, oblivious to my panic. Another half hour or so brought us to a break in the trees. A steep slope led down to the frozen river. I heard the roller dam faintly to my right. I could see a little farther here without the trees overhead, but the other side of the river was completely shrouded in darkness. Darla got down to the river by sitting down and sliding on her butt. I waited a moment for her to move out of the way and then slid to join her. Walking across the Mississippi felt like exploring an alien planet. The darkness hid everything but the tiny circles of ice on which we planted our feet. Our boots made weird squeaks and crunching sounds. I feared we might walk through this dark limbo forever, slowing gradually until we froze in place, statues lost from their museum, admired by no one. Chapter 22. I saw Darla's shoulders trembling and said, "Let's pick up the pace." "Yeah, Christ, I'm cold." "And hungry," I added. "Thirsty, too. I'd even eat some snow, but that'd just make me colder." We started jogging across the ice. Darla fell twice. Both times she took my hand, levered herself up, and kept going without comment. Wiping out had to hurt, but she ignored the pain, determined to keep us moving forward. It seemed like it was taking way too long to cross the river. I mean, yeah, the Mississippi is huge, but we'd been jogging 20 or 30 minutes. "How much farther?" I asked. "How should I know? Keep moving." Her voice was huffy from exertion or annoyance. Not 5 minutes later, we finally reached the bank. "Head downstream following the bank," Darla said. "That'll take us farther away from the barge." "Yeah." We jogged south, away from the lock and barges, skirting around big snowdrifts. After a while, the bank started to curve to the right. As we followed it, I noticed the trees were bigger here. Their branches hung far out over the river ice. When I caught a glimpse of a tree to our left, I figured out where we were, traveling into an inlet, a frozen tributary of the Mississippi. Darla stopped. "Let's make a camp here. That bend should shield us from anyone at the lock." "Okay, so how are we going to build a fire?" "Rubbing sticks together." My chest sank. That's going to take for freaking ever." "Not the way we're going to do it." Darla explained what she wanted me to do. I had to do most of the work. Darla was still shivering badly and spent a lot of time running in place or slapping her legs, trying to stay warm. I split a small cottonwood log twice, forming a roughly flat plank that Darla called a fireboard. Another piece of the log became a small, rounded grip, a thunderhead, again according to Darla. I whittled an 8-sided spindle out of a cottonwood branch. A long, curved oak branch became a bow, and one of my bootlaces served as a bowstring. I discovered that the inner bark of cottonwood trees would shred nicely to form a fine, dry fire starter or bird's nest. It took more than an hour to gather and make everything we needed. Then we put it together and tested it. I wrapped the bowstring around the spindle, which I placed vertically between the fireboard and thunderhead. The idea was that I'd use one hand to hold the thunderhead in place and the other to pump the bow back and forth to rotate the spindle. In turn, that'd generate friction between the spindle and fireboard, and hopefully create a spark. Of course it didn't work. The bootlace slipped on the spindle, and we had to tighten it. Then the spindle kept flying off the fireboard, and we had to cut a deeper dimple to keep the spindle in place. While we worked on fixing our makeshift fire-by-friction set, I asked Darla where she'd learned how to build it. "From Max's Boy Scout handbook," she replied. "I thought he'd quit Scouts after a month." She shrugged. "I didn't know that. I just thought the book looked interesting. And it was." Finally, we got it all working. I sawed back and forth on the bow, holding the Thunderhead with my other hand, trying to keep even pressure on it. Both ends of the spindle started smoking in surprisingly little time, just a minute or two. About 30 seconds after the spindle started smoking, a spark fell out of the Thunderhead onto my glove. I froze, trying to avoid any sudden move that might extinguish the spark, not caring if it burned my hand. It winked out. "Well, at least we know it works," Darla said. "The spark is supposed to come from the fireboard, not the Thunderhead. I wonder what we're doing wrong." We set it up again. I was surprised by the spindle. It was noticeably shorter. Deep black holes had been drilled in both the fireboard and Thunderhead. Darla put one hand over mine on the Thunderhead and grabbed the other end of the bow. Working together, we could pump the bow much faster and more smoothly. Less than 30 seconds had passed before smoke was pouring from both ends of the spindle. I heard a cracking noise, and the Thunderhead broke. The end of the spindle hit my palm, twisting the nylon and burning my hand through the glove. I snatched my hand back, and the spindle went flying. It had drilled clear through both the Thunderhead and fireboard. I shook my hand and looked down. The hole in the bottom of the fireboard was nearly filled by a huge spark glowing atop the ash. "Now I know what we were doing wrong," Darla said. "We were supposed to put a notch in the fireboard to let out the spark. Probably supposed to lubricate the Thunderhead somehow, too." I gently lifted the fireboard. There were bits of snow and ice around the spark on the floor of our foxhole. If any of those melted, our spark would be extinguished. I picked up my knife and slid the blade under the spark. Slowly, very slowly, I lifted the spark while groping around for the bird's nest. Darla placed it in my hand. I gently slid the spark off my knife and into the nest, cupped in my left palm. The spark was growing, igniting some of the black dust I'd scooped up along with it. I scooped some more of the dust from the fireboard with the blade of my knife and gently fed it to the spark. It grew larger still, a glowing coal nestled in the shredded bark on my palm. I whispered to my spark, letting my breath coax it. "Burn, burn, damn it, burn." And with a pop and whoosh, it obeyed. The bird's nest flared to life. I set it down slowly, not caring if it singed my fingers. We had made fire, created life. We fed the fire together, starting with slivers of leftover wood and quickly moving on to twigs and branches. Darla's hands shook so badly that the twigs she dropped occasionally missed the fire altogether. I shuddered to think what might have happened if the fire-by-friction set hadn't worked. I took the hatchet and cut 3 long limbs with forks on their ends. By jamming each branch into the snow and interweaving the forked ends, I created a rough tripod next to our fire. I took Darla's frozen clothing off my belt and draped it over the tripod to dry. Darla was huddled right up against the fire, getting warm. I squatted next to her. "Let me see your hand," I said. She held out her right hand, and I pulled off her glove. She had 2 roughly parallel, crescent-shaped wounds between her palm and the base of her middle finger. Benson had bitten her so hard he'd drawn blood. The bite was scabbed over, but the flesh around it was red and swollen. I got some clean snow to scrub her wound. When I started washing it, Darla screamed. I found a mostly clean, leftover piece of cottonwood and gave it to her to bite. "Sorry," I said, "I gotta clean it." Darla nodded, tears rolling down her face. I kissed her cheek, tasting salt. She laid her hand back in my lap, and I resumed scrubbing while she cried. "I think it's getting infected," I said as I finished. Darla just moaned. I put her glove back on and rooted around in my jacket for a minute. I'd kept the Cipro tablets zipped into my inner pocket with the kale seeds. I took out a tablet and handed it to Darla. "Take this." She spit the piece of wood out from between her teeth. "They're for you." "I'll take a half." "How many do you have left?"
"5, counting that one."
"Aren't you supposed to take antibiotics for like 10 days or something?"
"Doc said 7. I'll take a half.
If you take full ones today and tomorrow and then go to halves like me, we can make 5 tablets last 3 more days. By then, maybe we'll be in Worthington. Maybe we'll be able to buy some more."
"My mouth is too dry to swallow this damn horse pill."
"I'll get some clean snow." We had no pan to melt the snow in, so we put little balls of it in our mouths to melt. That was tolerable with the fire roaring beside us. Darla swallowed her Cipro, and I cut a tablet in half with my knife. The rough edge of the tablet caught in my throat. I had to eat a bunch more snow to choke it down and wash away the nasty taste it left in my mouth. Then we cleared off snow from a larger area to sleep in. By the time we'd done that, we needed more firewood. So we spent at least 30 minutes chopping enough wood to last through the night. I felt woolly, like I'd been awake for 3 days straight. My eyelids drooped, and I had to force myself to concentrate as I chopped wood lest the hatchet miss and add to our growing inventory of injuries. But Darla looked even worse. Her eyes made a pair of black holes in her face. She was yawning almost nonstop. "Go to sleep," I said. "I'll take first watch."
"We can both sleep if we build up the fire first."
"What if Blacklake finds us? We better take turns." Darla used a couple of small logs and one of her scarves to make a crude pillow, and then she lay down beside the fire. Within seconds, her breathing slowed as sleep claimed her. I wanted nothing more than to curl up around her and sleep too, but I knew it wasn't safe. I sat in the volcanic ash beside Darla and watched her chest slowly rise and fall. The firelight played in her hair. I reached out to stroke it, but thought better of it and pulled my hand away. I didn't want to wake her. I felt suddenly morose. What was I doing, dragging Darla back to Iowa? Her parents were dead. She had no particular reason to want to find mine. Already she'd been injured. If I got Darla killed on this insane trip, I wouldn't be able to live with myself. Chapter 23. I struggled to stay alert, trudging back and forth beside the fire. When I saw the first hint of dawn in the east, I shook Darla awake. "I gotta sleep," I said. She mumbled something and pushed herself upright. I was fast asleep before my head fully settled on the log. It seemed like no time at all had passed when Darla pushed on my shoulder, saying, "Alex, wake up." I startled fully awake, sat up, and looked around. "Something wrong?"
"No, everything's okay, but we should get going."
"What time is it?"
"I don't know, around noon, maybe."
Darla was dressed in her own clothes, and my coveralls were laid out on the tripod by the fire. I slipped my toasty warm coveralls on, struggling to pull the legs over my boots. Darla fiddled with a bundle of wood.
"What's that?" I asked.
"I worked on the fire by friction set while you were asleep. Made a new thunderhead out of oak so it won't burn through. We've got 2 extra spindles now, too. Here's your shoelace." I started relacing my boot while Darla tied all the fire by friction stuff into a neat bundle using a drawstring she'd cannibalized from her jacket. We kicked snow over the fire, tore down the tripod, and set out.
"Which way?" I asked.
"Maybe follow this creek upstream? Easier to walk on the ice. Hopefully we'll hit a road."
"How far is it to Worthington?"
"I don't know exactly. We're near Bellevue. It's about 30 miles from Worthington to Dubuque, but I think Bellevue is farther.
Maybe 40 or 45 miles? That's going to take forever if we have to walk through deep snow, and I'm already famished. Let's see what the roads are like. If they're bad, maybe I can improvise some snowshoes. We'd walked along the creek until we reached a railroad trestle that passed about 20 feet above the ice. Beyond that, I saw the concrete pylons and steel girders of a highway bridge. We walked under the railroad trestle and turned to fight our way up the bank between the two bridges. The bank wasn't steep, but the snow was so deep that it was difficult to force our way upward. For every step we managed, we slid half a step back. Finally, we got to the top, only to confront an enormous berm of plowed snow alongside the road. I led the way up the berm, thrusting my hands into the snow to make tenuous grips and kicking footholds into the side of the pile. The snow here was a filthy blend of volcanic ash and ice plowed off the road. We hid near the top of the berm, watching the road for more than an hour. Nothing moved. There was no sound but the chattering of our teeth. I was worried about patrols, but it would take too long to get to Worthington traveling cross-country. I got down the far side of the berm to the road by sliding on my butt. We were on a two-lane, plowed highway. "You think all the roads are this good?" I said. "I hope so." Darla stood and dusted the snow off herself. "We'll make good time on this. Maybe get to Worthington in 2.5 days. Before we starve, anyway." I guess there's one advantage to FEMA being in Iowa now. Last year, none of the roads on this side of the river had been plowed. "That's the only good those ass puppets do." "Yeah." I looked up and down the highway. "Which way?" "Right, north. Worthington is northwest of us somewhere."
"Won't that take us closer to the lock and Black Lake?"
"Yeah, we'll turn west as soon as we can." We made great time on the packed snow of the road. We didn't talk. I was listening for engine noises and continually glancing behind us. I hoped there wouldn't be any Black Lake trucks, but if any trucks did come, I wanted time to try to get away, although that might be impossible. The piles of snow and ash alongside the road were so high that we were essentially trapped. We got off the highway onto a back road at the first opportunity. Darla led us through a dizzying succession of turns, heading north and west, she said. The roads were all deserted, which was a relief, but also a little bit puzzling. Why bother plowing roads nobody was going to use? We passed 6 or 7 farmsteads. All of them were clearly abandoned. About half the houses had burned. "Why do you think so many houses are burned?" I asked. "Probably people took shelter in them and lit fires in places they shouldn't have," she replied. "You build a wood fire in a hearth that's only designed for a gas log, you'll burn the house down quick-like." As twilight set in, we stopped at a farmstead. It consisted of 2 cylindrical concrete grain silos and a 1-story farmhouse. There were 3 hillocks of snow that might have been collapsed barns or sheds. I couldn't tell. The front door and door trim of the farmhouse were missing. A drift of snow more than 2 feet deep graced the entryway. It was too dark inside to see much, but what I could see wasn't pretty. The house had been thoroughly looted. Furniture, doors, door trim, baseboards, and cabinets were all missing, probably burned as firewood. The mantle around the living room fireplace was gone, leaving an ugly hole in the wall, but there was a tiled area around the fireplace where we could safely build a fire. A big sooty stain proved we weren't the first people to build a fire there, although there were no other signs of past occupants. Darla started setting up the fire by friction set while I looked for wood. Everything burnable inside the house was gone. There were a bunch of trees outside, but all the lower limbs and smaller trees had been cut. I picked out the smallest of the remaining trees and started the long process of felling it with my hatchet, a job that really required a chainsaw or at least a full-size axe. It was almost an hour later and fully dark by the time I returned to the living room with an armload of wood. I could barely make out Darla's form hunched over a tiny, glowing spark. This is so cool. This black dust the set makes will keep a spark alive, like, forever. We've got to find some way to store this stuff.
Sorry it took so long. Had to cut a tree down to get at the branches.
It's okay. Make me a bird's nest, would you?
It was so dark, I could barely see anything. I stripped the bark from a couple of branches, working by feel. I took off my gloves to make it easier to shred the bark, and soon my hands were freezing. Darla stayed hunched over her spark, feeding it with black powder from the fire by friction set, and fanning it gently with her knife blade.
I think this thing is ready, I said, holding the bird's nest out to Darla.
Just hold it next to the spark. Darla cut the spark in two with her knife and lifted half of it into the bird's nest. I slowly lifted the bird's nest to my lips. I whispered to it, "Burn, baby, burn," letting the gentle breath of my whisper fan the spark. Darla was feeding the other half of the spark more black powder, building it up in case mine died. A strand of bark flared orange, looking like the filament in an old-fashioned incandescent light bulb. A tiny flame followed, and in seconds the whole bird's nest was engulfed in fire. I laid it down in the middle of the tiled area. It threw off just enough light that I could find pieces of kindling to feed it. Darla abandoned the rest of the spark and helped me feed the fire. I offered to get more wood, but it was so dark out that I wasn't sure I could find the tree I felled again. I took a flaming stick out of the fire, hoping to use it as a torch. It went out before I even reached the front doorway. I bent low, using the faint glow of the embers still clinging to my stick to follow my footprints back to the tree. I was worried that I wouldn't be able to find my way back to the house, but the glow of the fire was clearly visible through the open maw left by the missing front door. That aroused a new worry. What if someone came by? It would be obvious from the light that we were camping in the abandoned house. But we hadn't seen anyone on the roads all day, and it would be even harder to travel by night. I broke more small branches and carried them back to the house.
"We're going to need some bigger logs to keep the fire going all night," Darla said as I dropped the wood.
"I can't see well enough to use the hatchet," I replied. Darla gathered up several long, slender branches, arranging them in a bunch. She thrust one end into the fire. When she pulled it out, the tip of the bundle was engulfed in a steady flame that survived movement, unlike the single branch I'd used.
"Come on, I'll hold the light for you."
With Darla clutching her makeshift torch and me chopping, we got enough wood to last the night. By the time we finished, I was hungry and thirsty. I'd been hungry all day. There was nothing I could do about that. But the thirst I could deal with. "I'm going to get some snow," I said. I didn't bother taking a torch. Snow was easy to find. It was everywhere. I molded two cantaloupe-sized snowballs and carried them inside. Darla took one, broke off a piece, and put it in her mouth to melt.
"Just when I get warm, I've got to eat this damn snow," she said.
"Beats going without water."
"I guess. Let me see the hatchet."
I passed the hatchet to her. She wandered around the bare living room for a minute, staring at the ceiling and floor and holding the hatchet by her side. Just as I was getting ready to ask her what in the world she was doing, she gripped the hatchet firmly in two hands and buried it with a thunk in the floor. She swung the hatchet like a madwoman, chopping at the floor. Tufts of ash-filled, mildewed carpet flew everywhere. Darla was quickly coated in ash and dirt. She looked like a chimney sweep turned axe murderer, completely insane. Chapter 24.
"What are you doing?" I yelled. "I am sick," the hatchet thunked back into the carpet. "Of eating?"
A chunk of wood from the subfloor flew up.
"Snow!" Darla slammed the hatchet back into the floor.
"Take it easy. How's killing the floor going to help?" Darla didn't answer, just kept destroying the floor. I saw wood joists and a rectangular metal heating duct through the ragged hole she'd opened. Darla turned her attention to the heating duct, slamming the hatchet into it with a clang and screech of tearing metal. I heard another noise when Darla hit the duct,
an almost musical tinkling, kind of like a bottle rolling on the sidewalk. It seemed to be coming from the far side of the room beneath one of the windows. I followed the path of the duct with my eye. It led straight to a grate in the floor. I stepped over to the grate, giving Darla and the wildly swinging hatchet a wide berth. She was still wailing on the ductwork, trying to cut it or rip it out of the floor. Had the cold and hunger tipped her over the edge? I couldn't see what was holding the grate in place, so I got my fingernails under its edges and pulled it up. It came free fairly easily. The duct behind it jerked and shivered as Darla whacked the other end of it. I clearly heard something rolling around. I reached down into the duct and withdrew a half-full bottle of Canadian Mist. "Hey," I yelled, "check this out." "Just a sec." Darla was totally focused on butchering the heating duct. A big chunk of it came free with a metallic shriek. She set aside the chunk of metal and let the arm holding the hatchet fall. "That was in the duct?" "Yeah, someone must have hidden it down there. You think we should drink it?" "I don't know. Alcohol has calories. Maybe it would help." I unscrewed the cap and sniffed the bottle. Even the smell of alcohol made my empty stomach turn and clench. I'd probably barf. "Yeah, let me finish, and then we'll put that whiskey to good use." Darla started hacking at the piece of ductwork with the hatchet and knife. The sheet metal was thin and soft enough that our knife would cut it, although Darla was straining at it, holding the duct in one hand and sawing the knife back and forth with the other. I groaned, thinking about what she was doing to the edge of the knife. We didn't have a sharpening stone. But saying anything was useless. Getting between Darla and our project was as futile as standing on a railroad track hoping to stop a train with an upraised palm. So I watched while Darla shaped the sheet metal into a rough, square pan. Each corner had a triangular fold, and the top was sharp and ragged, but it looked like it would hold water. "Ta-da," she said. "No more eating snow." "That's great, but will the hatchet still cut wood?" Darla picked it up and looked at the edge. Even by the firelight, the nicks and dull spots were obvious. "We'll look for a stone to sharpen it on tomorrow." I shrugged and loaded the balls of snow into the pan. Darla set the pan at the edge of the fire. Then she plucked the bottle of whiskey from the floor. Darla sniffed the whiskey and wrinkled her nose. She lifted the bottle to her lips and took a huge swig. "Ugh, that's disgusting," she said, coughing as she passed the bottle to me. Disgusting or not, I couldn't let Darla show me up. I raised the bottle to my mouth and knocked back as much as I could swallow at one gulp. It was horrid, a smell like paint thinner and a sharp taste so strong it burned my throat. I bent double, gasping and coughing, trying to clear the alcohol sear from my nostrils. Once that passed, though, it tasted kind of good for a few seconds, sort of like smoke from a campfire. But the pleasant taste passed, too, and then I was left with nothing but the chemical aftertaste of the cheap whiskey. "Maybe this stuff does have calories, but I don't think I want to drink any more," I said. "Me either," Darla replied. "Maybe we can find some real food tomorrow. Save the rest of the alcohol to use as an antiseptic." "Makes sense. Let me see your hand." I gently stripped off the makeshift bandage from Darla's palm. The wound looked better, a little puffy and swollen, but there were no red streaks, and it didn't smell bad. I washed it as best as I could with whiskey, then rebandaged it, using more cloth torn from my undershirt. "Your turn." Darla took the whiskey bottle and went to work on my side. It looked a lot better. The red streaks had mostly faded, and it didn't smell like roadkill anymore. By the time Darla finished washing and bandaging me, we'd torn up more than half my t-shirt. All that remained were the shoulders, neck, and a ragged fringe of cloth hanging partway down my chest. "If you keep using my clothes for bandages at this rate, I'll be naked in a few days," I said. Darla laughed. "Fine by me. I'll enjoy the naked boyfriend show. Might be a bit cold for you, though." She pulled the makeshift pan away from the fire. All the snow had melted. "Yeah, maybe I'll wait until we get somewhere warmer before I let you rip all my clothing to rags." "Deal." We waited a bit for the pan to cool, then carefully sipped water from its sharp edges. "We've got 6 bags of wheat. Maybe we should cook one?" "We don't need to," Darla said. "We should make it to Worthington the day after tomorrow." "Better to keep up our strength. How do you cook wheat anyway?" Darla shrugged. "Boil it like corn? I don't know." I refilled the pan with snow. When that melted, I dumped a bag of wheat in. While I waited for that to boil, I whittled flat spots on a couple of sticks, improvised spoons. I had no idea how long to cook it. After about 15 minutes of boiling, I scooped out a few kernels with my stick. They were so hard that they were difficult to chew, and they had an unpleasant, hairy texture. "How is it?" Darla asked. "Not good." She frowned. "Let's get some sleep. Figure it out in the morning." I pulled the pan off the fire and started getting ready for bed. We hadn't had any Cipro yet that day, so I split a tablet and handed half of it to Darla. She choked it down with a grimace. The floor beside the fire was hard, but we were so tired it didn't matter. I wrapped Darla up in a hug and kissed her goodnight. We slept like that, our limbs entangled, warmed by each other and the comfort of our hard-won fire. Chapter 25. The next morning, I tried the wheat again. The pan was warm from sitting by the fire all night. Soaking overnight had transformed the kernels. They were soft and delicious. Darla and I quickly ate them all. When we'd finished breakfast, I packed the makeshift pan, the bottle of whiskey, and the remaining bags of wheat under my coat. I cinched the drawstring around my waist extra tight so everything would stay put. Darla carried the fire by friction set under her jacket, the bow sticking out at her collar. We looked lumpy and awkward, strange aliens trudging across the snowscape. The pan rubbed uncomfortably as I moved, its edges digging into my chest through the coveralls and overshirt. The countryside reinforced my feeling of strangeness. Last year, more than half the Iowa farmsteads had been occupied. Many of the unoccupied ones had collapsed under the weight of the ash and snow, but very few had burned. Now, all of them were abandoned, and more than half had burned. Often, all that marked a former farm was a grain silo and some charred rubble. Where had all the people gone? A faint stench of charcoal, melted plastic, and sulfur followed us down the road. The burnt-out buildings made the countryside seem even more desolate. The only break in the solitude came late that morning. We heard an engine in the distance and rushed to the side of the road, thinking we'd hide. But the noise faded, and we never saw the vehicle that made it. Iowa had been a vibrant place just 10 months ago. Even on the back roads, you could always see signs of civilization, of people. Now, nothing. What kind of life could Darla and I hope for in this desolation? I took her hand and held it for a while as we walked. I was hungry despite the half pan of boiled wheat I'd eaten that morning. The hunger made us tired. Our steps slowed as the day wore on, and we barely talked. About an hour before nightfall, we passed a whole series of burnt houses. All that remained were a few scarred and blackened brick walls and chimneys. We trudged up a slight rise. At the top perched a dark blue, cylindrical water tower overlooking the town. Cascade, it read, in huge white block letters. Below the town's name, someone had spray-painted a crude drawing of a woodpecker in garish red and neon blue. The woodpecker stood on its hind legs, wings thrust into the air some 20 feet above its head. Fat red boxing gloves capped each of the woodpecker's upraised wings. "Excellent," Darla said. "Cascade is only 10 miles from Worthington. But what is that drawing on the water tower?" "Woody Woodpecker," I said. "Woody what?" "You know, the cartoon. I tried to make the Woody Woodpecker sound, but it didn't come out too well." She looked at me like I'd lost my mind. "You've never heard of Woody Woodpecker?" I asked. "No. Country people." I shook my head in mock seriousness. "They lack cultural awareness. Darla slugged my shoulder. Well, if that's a woodpecker, it's got a huge evolutionary advantage.
What's that?
It's so ugly, trees will die at the sight of it.
Yeah, it is ugly.
I wonder why someone bothered painting it up there. Must have taken a lot of spray paint to make it that big. As we got closer, we could see beyond the water tower. There was an open snowfield boxed in by two small apartment buildings and a massive metal shed. The shed's sliding door was open, and we could see a fire flickering within.
I think I see people moving by that fire, Darla whispered.
Check it out, I asked. See if they look friendly?
Yeah, but stay hidden till we're sure.
We crept closer, keeping below the level of the wall of plowed snow that lined the road. Once we were within a few hundred feet, Darla and I slowly raised our heads. Inside the shed, four men clustered around a small, bright yellow machine. They were big guys, heavily muscled and tattooed. They looked like they'd been eating well. Three women sat by the fire. Two of them had their backs to us. They were working on something in their laps. The other woman was hunched over the fire, cooking.
What's that machine they're working on? I whispered. A jet ski?
Darla shook her head.
A jet ski? What would they do with that? It's a snowmobile, she hissed.
One of the women stood up. She carried a crude mortar and pestle. She dumped ground meal out of her mortar into a paper bag and scooped something from a feed stack. Behind her, I saw something roasting on a spit over the fire. A leg. Chapter 26. Is that... I asked.
It's too thin to be a cow's leg, Darla whispered. Too long to be a pig's.
Let's get out of here.
We need to find a place to spend the night.
Not in this town. Darla started crawling beside the snow berm. I followed on my hands and knees. We didn't stand up until we'd left the metal building far behind. Cascade was wrecked. We moved slowly and silently, sticking to the shadowed area alongside the road. Burnt, partially collapsed buildings flanked us, leaning in like gravestones in an unkempt cemetery. We reached a major intersection. On the far side, a mostly collapsed building still sported its bright red Conoco sign. The area in front of the building, where the gas pumps used to be, was now nothing but a fire-seared crater. A sign clung to a fallen light pole, Highway 136.
Right turn here.
Darla's voice was so soft I could barely make out her words. The building on the corner to our right had burnt, too. Only its brick walls still stood. A half-melted plastic sign read, Tri-County Bank. Below that, someone had spray-painted a crude drawing of a woodpecker similar to the much larger one on the water tower. I shuddered, and we hurried past the bank's abandoned shell. As we reached the outskirts of Cascade, total darkness fell. Darla and I held hands and stumbled along more by feel than by sight. After about 20 minutes, I felt a break in the berm at the road's edge. I groped around, trying to figure out if we'd come to a crossroads. To my right, there was a steep uphill slope. It was strange. The slope was concrete, not snow or ice. I struggled partway up it, trying to figure out what it was. It was far too steep to be a road. The underside of a girder loomed in the darkness. We were under a highway overpass. There was a low, flat shelf at the top of the slope. The girders were at least 5 feet high. I could stand upright in between them.
Let's stop here for the night, I said. We're still too close to Cascade, Darla whispered.
It's sheltered here and hidden. We're going to freeze if we keep going. I lay down on the concrete floor of our hidey hole. It was intensely cold, chilling my side almost immediately. I wanted a fire for warmth and to cook more wheat, but the flames would have stood out like a beacon. Darla lay next to me, and I wrapped an arm around her, pulling her close. We were both shivering. Darla pushed back against me until we were sandwiched together, as close as any two people who still have all their clothes on can be. Eventually, our shivers subsided, and I fell into a fitful sleep. In the morning, I woke to the rattle of gunfire. Chapter 27. I elbowed Darla, but she was already awake. The pop-pop of gunfire was faint, coming from our north, the direction of Worthington, but drawing steadily closer. I could barely make out the muted roar of distant engines, but that noise wasn't tied to a direction. It seemed to be coming from all around us. I peered to the north. The light was good. We'd slept at least an hour past dawn, but I couldn't yet locate the source of the noises. "Let's move," I whispered. "Yeah." Darla rolled over and started crawling to the north, away from Cascade and toward the gunfire. "The other way," I hissed. Darla kept going. "We need to know what's happening." The gunfire grew louder as we reached the edge of the overpass. A few miles off, a line of trucks raced directly toward us. "They're going to pass right through here," I whispered. "Let's get on top of the overpass and hide." We turned around and crawled as quickly as we could toward the other side of the overpass. There were two bridges above us, both sides of a divided highway with a gap in between. I forced my way through the snow that had fallen between the bridges and wormed to the south side of the overpass. Peeking out, I discovered why the engine sounds seemed to be coming from all around us. Another line of four vehicles was barreling toward us from Cascade to our south. They were small and low, each one kicking up a plume of snow in the air behind it.
"Snowmobiles," Darla said. "Christ!"
As we watched, the snowmobiles spread out to surround the south side of the overpass in a rough semicircle. The one closest to us stopped, and the two men riding it dismounted and pulled long guns from a saddlebag. They wore military-style fatigues and camo jackets.
"Let's go,"
I tugged on Darla's jacket. We crawled as quickly as we could to the center of the overpass. When I reached the break between the bridges, I darted out from under the ledge and started crawling my way upward through the deep snow on the embankment. I scrabbled with my arms and pumped my legs in and out of the snow, high-stepping, thrusting with panic-fueled urgency. It probably only took us 10 seconds to race up the slope, but it seemed like forever. I hurled myself over the snowbank that edged the road atop the overpass. Darla crashed into me a second later.
"What the hell is going on?" Darla asked. "No idea."
I dashed onto the bridge and peered over the snow berm to the north. The gunfire had gotten louder. Four trucks raced along the road in a column, only a few hundred yards from us and approaching fast. The closest was a modern pickup, followed immediately by a cloth-topped, army-style deuce and a half. After the cloth-topped truck, there was a gap, and then came two ancient pickups, the type with big, rounded fenders and small wooden load beds. Both the antique trucks were packed with men wearing a ragged array of clothing, 5 or 6 squeezed onto the back of each truck. Two guys on the closer of the old pickups were leaning over the top of the cab, firing rifles at the deuce in the front of them. I thought I saw the muzzle flash of returned fire, but couldn't be sure.
"Oh my God," I said. "It's an ambush. The first two trucks are luring the old pickups through the overpass. On the other side, all those guys on snowmobiles are perfectly set up to massacre them."
"Great," Darla replied. "We'd better hide and sneak out of here when it's all over." The guys on the old pickups looked like farmers to me, and they were driving into a bandit ambush. I clenched my fists.
"We've got to stop it." "Alex, wait!"
I scrambled to the top of the snow berm and stood up. It was a long drop in front of me down the far side of the berm and off the edge of the bridge. I wavered a moment, then started yelling and waving my arms.
"Get down, you idiot!" Darla screamed.
She started scrambling up the snow berm toward me. All four trucks roared toward us. I pointed at the first old pickup and held my arms out, palms forward, in a gesture to stop.
A spray of snow kicked up beside my feet, and the pop of a gunshot sounded from my left. The first pickup roared under the bridge directly below me. I glanced to my left. I could barely see one of the guys from the snowmobiles lying atop the snow berm a couple of hundred yards off, pointing a rifle at me. I felt Darla's hands grab my right arm. She wrenched me around, throwing me down. I heard another gunshot. Darla exhaled heavily, a quiet oof. A red stain bloomed on her right shoulder, and everything slowed around me. Her knees crumpled, and she slid down the outside of the snow berm. I lunged toward her. Snow plumed into the air beside me, and another gunshot sounded. I grabbed for her. My hand caught in her hair. It tore from her scalp, and Darla slipped away. Chapter 28. Darla fell from the overpass and landed on her back with a whump of compressed fabric on the roof of the cloth-top deuce passing underneath us. My scarf followed her, twisting in the wind. I teetered on top of the snow berm for a split second, afraid to jump after her, a hesitation I would regret for the rest of my life. I was left holding a clump of her hair and the necklace I'd given her, now broken. The truck passed under the bridge, and she was gone. I ran for the south side of the overpass, hoping to catch the truck there. As I ran, I jammed the broken necklace into the pocket of my coveralls. The situation seemed impossible. I couldn't run as fast as the truck was moving, let alone cross the gap between the lanes of the highway in time. Something punched my right arm, and I heard another gunshot. The impact spun me partway around and knocked me off balance. To my west, the guy with the rifle was aiming, lining up yet another shot at me. Running across the road in full view of him was suicide. I turned away from him, sprinting east and dodging back and forth, hoping to make him miss. I felt the wet heat of blood flowing down my right arm. I heard another gunshot, but didn't feel or see anything. A miss. When I reached the northern edge of the overpass, I scrambled up the snow berm and threw myself over the other side. I slid face first down the snow berm and then down the long embankment to the base of the overpass. Flecks of snow flew into my eyes and ice abraded my cheek. The two old pickups had pulled up and stopped north of the overpass. A guy jumped out of the lead truck's load bed and ran up to me. I pushed to my feet and turned to run to follow the cloth-top truck with its precious cargo under the bridge. My red scarf was pooled on the icy road. The guy grabbed me. Pain so intense that my fingertips tingled shot through me when his fingers closed around my right arm. I fought down dizziness and tried to pull away. "Why were you trying to signal us?" the man demanded. "Let go!" I tried to punch, aiming for his radial nerve. He caught my other arm before my punch could connect. I was weak, slowed by hunger and shock. "You signaled to stop," the guy shouted. "Why? What's on the other side of that overpass?" "Let go," I yelled again. "Darla, I've got to get to Darla." The words didn't come out clearly. I realized I was sobbing. The man let go of my right arm and slapped me. The blow rocked my head sideways, brought fire to my face, and stopped my sobbing. "What's on the other side of the overpass?" he yelled. I sucked in a deep breath. "It's an ambush. There are eight guys on snowmobiles set up on the far side in a semicircle. If you go under that bridge, it'll be a massacre." The guy turned toward his buddies in the truck, still holding one of my arms. "Ambush! Eight snowmobiles! Far side of the overpass!" They all readied their rifles. Four guys jumped down from the truck to take up flanking positions on either side of the road. "Four snowmobiles, eight guys," I said. "Now let me go. I've got to go after Darla." I thrashed, trying to break the guy's grip. I reached across my body with my left hand and dug my fingers under his pinky. That put more pressure on my wound, and pain spiked up my arm so intensely I saw colored lights. I ignored it as best I could, concentrating on bending his pinky backward. "The biggest guy in the world can be holding you, but if it's your whole hand against his pinky, you can break his grip or his finger, either of which should do the trick. The guy holding me let go rather than allowing me to break his pinky, and I cranked his hand around, twisting him into an armbar. I could have broken his elbow or kicked him in the nuts, but I was just trying to get away. I settled for a round kick to the back of his legs, forcing him to his knees in the icy road. Then I turned to run. Another guy had jumped down from the back of the pickup and planted himself squarely in my path. He looked familiar. "You run under that bridge, you're dead for sure," he said. He grabbed the collar of my coveralls as I tried to dodge around him. The driver's window was down. The guy at the wheel said, "Just let him go. What do we care if he gets his full head shot off?" "He saved us from a serious ass-kicking," the guy holding me said. "This is how you show your gratitude?" I tried to snake my right arm through his arms, preparing to throw him off, but a burst of pain so intense that it left me gasping stopped me. "I've seen you before," he said, "in Worthington, with Darla Edmonds." Suddenly I placed the guy, the sheriff who'd met us outside Worthington last year. He was thinner now and had a nasty, puckered scar running along his left cheek. "I remember you. I'm Alex. I've got to get out of here. Now." "Earl, how?" "They've got Darla. She fell under the roof of that army truck. She's been shot. I've got to go after her."
"Thought you said there was an ambush over there."
"There is, but that's the way Darla went."
"Guys on snowmobiles are probably part of that bandit gang we were chasing. You go through there alone, you're dead," Earl said.
"Well, come with me then."
"We drive into that ambush, we might all die. Wouldn't do us or Darla any good. And these pickups are no good in deep snow. We can't get around and flank them."
"But they can flank you pretty easy on their snowmobiles. They had a scout up on the overpass. Guy who shot Darla." I glanced at my arm. "And me." The outside of my coat dripped blood.
"We should see to that arm," Earl said. "Looks like it needs stitching."
I scanned the top of the overpass. My eye caught on a flash of gold, blonde hair peeking out from under a watch cap. "Up there, peeking over the snow berm," I pointed with my left arm. One of the guys still on the truck lifted his rifle, took aim, and fired. The scout on the overpass ducked below the snow berm.
"Damn, you missed him," Earl said.
"What are we going to do about Darla?" I said.
"We should bandage your arm," Earl replied.
"Hell with my arm," I yelled. "How are we going to get Darla back?"
"You aren't any use to her at all if you bleed out," Earl replied mildly.
One of the other guys in the pickup bed turned toward us. He had a pair of binoculars dangling from his neck.
"Earl, snowmobile to our west, about a half mile."
"They're flanking us," Earl yelled. "Pull out, back to Worthington."
Earl pulled me toward the truck. I whipped my left through his arms and spun, using my forearm like a crowbar to wrench myself free. The guy who'd grabbed me the first time was standing behind me now, trying to nab me again. I kicked his legs out from under him and turned back to the overpass in time to see Earl's fist just before it crashed into my temple. Everything went black.
Chapter 29. I saw Darla's face, hair streaming past as she fell away from me. But now she was falling upward into the yellow-gray post-volcanic sky. I reached for her, but she faded, and my hand passed through her insubstantial form, stirring it like smoke until it dissipated. The ground under me bucked, and my shoulder blade hit hard enough to bruise. I realized that I was on my back in the pickup as it raced along the road. I sat up far too fast. Pain and nausea mounted a twin assault on my head and stomach. I twisted and vomited bile onto the wooden floorboards of the truck bed.
"You okay?" Earl laid his hand against my back.
"No." I shoved myself onto my feet, ignoring the protestations of my head and stomach. I stumbled, and Earl grabbed my left arm, holding me up.
"Worthington's a bit different from when you were here before," he said.
I held onto the back of the cab for support and looked around. A gleaming wall stretched away from the road, curving out of sight in both directions. It was a solid, vertical wall of ice about 16 feet high. A heavy wooden gate had been built across the road. Three guards struggled with each half of the gate, wrenching it open so the trucks could pass through.
"Impressive, ain't it?" Earl said.
"Yeah. It was amazing. I might have been awestruck if Darla had been there to see it with me. We built it with two bulldozers and a sprayer truck, bulldozed huge piles of snow, carved a vertical face, and then sprayed it down with water to freeze it solid."
I grunted. "Keeps us safe anyway, and it'll last exactly as long as we need it, till this cussed winter is over."
"I gotta get going." I took a step toward the back of the truck, wobbled, and would have fallen except for Earl's grip on my arm.
"You need to get that arm patched up," Earl said.
I glanced at it. He'd tied a rag around my right bicep. It was already blood-soaked. "I don't care. I'm going back to the bridge." I tried to twist free, but Earl held on.
"There's some hard facts to this situation," Earl said, talking in a low voice directly into my ear. "You said Darla got shot. That might have killed her. If that didn't kill her, then they might have flensed her by now. Easier to carry meat than a person."
"That couldn't be true. Darla was alive. She had to be. Let go," I shouted. I threw a punch at him, but my right arm was weak. He caught it and wrapped me in a bear hug.
"Don't make me hit you again, son. Hurt my dang knuckles. You come into town, get patched up. If the mayor gives the say-so, I'll take you back to the bridge and help you look for Darla."
We pulled through the gate, and a guard strained to close it behind us. As it crashed shut, Earl released me. On the inside, the wall was just an enormous pile of packed snow. Steps had been carved into it here and there so defenders against a siege could easily reach the makeshift battlement at the top. The pickups rolled slowly through town. Nobody was outside, but that wasn't surprising. It was too cold to be outdoors without a good reason. We pulled up at the low metal building that housed the library, city hall, and fire station, the same building where Darla and I had met with the town's librarian, Rita May, the year before. The fire truck that had been stuck outside was gone. Other than that and the deep snow, it looked about the same.
"Come on," Earl said. It was an order, not a suggestion.
I leaned against the roof of the cab, ignoring him. My mind whirled around the idea that Earl had planted, that Darla was dead. I kept approaching the concept in my thoughts and then skittering away from it, like trying to catch a porcupine barehanded.
"Let's go see the mayor," Earl said. I didn't respond.
Earl's hand pressed against my back between my shoulder blades.
"Look, son, I'm sorry about what I said to you, about Darla being dead and all. I know it wasn't Christian of me to put it that blunt, but lying to you wouldn't be doing you no kindness, neither."
I whirled and whipped my left hand towards his neck. I grabbed the collar of his coat and shook him so hard his head nodded involuntarily.
"Darla is alive," I growled.
"Okay, okay, let go of me." I released my grip on his collar.
Earl said, "If she's alive..."
"She is."
"Let me finish," Earl said.
"If she's alive, how are you going to find her? You've got no pack, no food, no weapons, nothing. You leave the city walls like that, you're gonna die. So help me. Gather up some men and let's go get her."
"I can't. Not without the mayor's say-so. I can't even let you stay inside the city walls unless she okays it. Things are tough. We're not taking in refugees, much as some might want to."
"Fine," I said. "Let's go see your mayor."
"That's all I was trying to do in the first place," Earl grumbled.
He led me through the middle door of the building labeled City Hall. My gut clenched with a fear as visceral as any I'd ever felt. I had to convince these people to help me, to find Darla, my Darla.
Chapter 30. Inside City Hall, there was a reception room with a desk. One wall was completely covered in a mismatched patchwork of every imaginable type of bulletin board. Cork, cloth, framed, unframed, tan, white, red, and black.
A crowd of people pressed around the boards, reading the hundreds of handwritten notices posted on them. Earl led me deeper into the building, past a row of office cubicles. One of them was occupied by an elderly woman doing some sort of paperwork. Three others continued